screen. Now Stratton swings around. He's ready once more. Throws and Gill lines the ball into right field for a base hit. Hops coming in on it. The runner from second is scoring. The runner from first, Gabby, who isn't very fast on his feet, stops at second. Single to right by Gill. Driving in Hack to make the score 3-1 in favor of the White Sox. And leaves Cub runners on first and second with one out, one run home in the second inning. And Bill Jurgis is back. Jurgis, the shortstop, at the plate. He's a right-handed hitter, stands there waiting as Stratton gets his time. And the hitter hits the ball, a slow bounder back to Hayes, who scoops it up, looks at the Appling, he throws it first, and it's a double play, a good fast double play. Hayes to Appling, to Venura for the second and third out.
A double play such as that one during a game between the Chicago White Sox and the Chicago Cubs back in 1936 can be exciting enough. But what about the Texas team that allowed 23 stolen bases and lost a game 44-0? Or the team that started their season with 37 consecutive wins? The world of minor league baseball is full of phenomenal records, winning and losing, and bizarre occurrences. I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Year. We're going to come across stories about a catcher who faked out a runner with a potato, and the third base coach who resorted to gunplay of a sort to stop an unmanageable base runner, and the pitcher traded for a plate of catfish. Those are just a few of the unlikely but true stories we're going to hear from Tim Haggerty, longtime sports broadcaster and author of Tales from the Dugout, published in 2023 by Cider Mill Press. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you, Norman.
Well, you have been at the announcing business for a long time, so I probably don't have to ask you where you got the inspiration for this book, Tales from the Dugout.
Well, in addition to doing play-by-play of baseball games, I've also always loved baseball research. And in 2012, I was researching something else, and I came across this newspaper archive from 1888, and it talked about a Texas League game being delayed when a wild bull ran on the field. And I thought to myself, well, I've never heard this story, and I cover this stuff for a living. So it just showed me there's so many baseball stories from the past and present that a lot of sports fans don't know about.
How do you go about digging those up, though? You can't just look for strange baseball stories, can you, or can you?
No, you're right. You can't, at least not that specifically. So I had this ongoing document for about 10 years. Whenever a current play or unusual event would happen, I'd make a note. For older stories, I use newspapers, archives. I also went through Spalding and Reach guides. This was an annual publication from the late 1800s through the early 1900s. Published every year, had all sorts of notes in it. Some of those are available through the Library of Congress. I made a trip to the Baseball Hall of Fame Library in Cooperstown, New York. They have a great full library there of publications that aren't available anywhere else. And also, just keeping notes anytime I interviewed somebody, a manager, a scout, a groundskeeper. You never know where you might find a story.
There was a column in the Saturday Evening Post back in the day called So You Think You Know Baseball. Did you ever run across that?
I did. I've seen the archives of that publication, Baseball Digest, which goes all the way back to the 1940s, with a subscription you can find their archives. And it was great. What I found about stories from back then is, of course, they didn't have the internet, so fact-checking was a little bit harder. So sometimes I'd flip through a publication like that, and they'd say, well, this player was with Albany in 1940. Well, now I learned that he actually played for Albany in 1941. So it left me some decisions. Okay, I'm going to write around that and say in the early 1940s.
Sure, you have to make those decisions. And it's probably going to be an ongoing process even now that the book is out. You'll find little discrepancies here and there. It seems inevitable because you have in this book, I'll give you the subtitle at this point, 1001 Humorous, Inspirational, and Wild Anecdotes from Minor League Baseball. Make a big distinction for us between the minor leagues and the major leagues. What are the minor leagues all about?
There's been various levels of minor league baseball all the way back to 1877. These days, AAA is the highest level. Milwaukee Brewers are consistently going from Milwaukee to Nashville. That's their AAA affiliate, back and forth. Below that, AA, High A, Single A, and then Rookie League. There's also independent league baseball. those, like the Milwaukee Milkmen, for example, they're professional players. They are paid, but they're not managed. They're not under the employment of a major league organization. So they're trying to get into affiliated baseball. And throughout baseball history, there's been various classifications. Really, the most minor league teams at a time was back in the 1940s. There were years that there were more than 400 different cities that had a minor league team. Really, any city big enough to have a train station had a professional baseball team. So to me, that's what was so fun about this book, is that there have been so many total games throughout history, leaving so many opportunities for wild happenings.
Well, yes, certainly that would be the case, as also things seem to have been a little bit less formalized if you go back, well, not that far, but certainly by the time you go back, your book goes back into the 1870s, 80s, and certainly into the 90s, and things get very interesting, very colorful, you might say. For example, just defining the playing field got a little nebulous. There was a case where a ball ran afoul of high tide.
Yes, this was in Galveston, Texas. Houston was playing a road game in Galveston and Beachfront Park, as it sounds. Their stadium was right there on the beach. And a Houston batter hit a deep fly ball then over the fence and into the Gulf of Mexico just as a wave arrived. And the wave stuffed the ball back underneath the wooden fence. So the outfielder picked up this soggy ball and threw it in. Meanwhile, the batter is just trotting and taking his time because he believes this is a home run. The catcher tags him out with these soaking wet baseball. And briefly, the umpire actually called him out until the team argued and said, no, that's a home run. Eventually, he gave him his home run. But yeah, the ball came back under from the ocean.
How does that work with argument and discussing things with the umpire? How often does a call actually get reversed like that?
Well, these days it happens more often because you have multiple umpires. At the AAA level, there's three umpires. In the major leagues, there's four or more. But back then, the umpire was a one-man show. And I say man because back then they were all males. There are some professional baseball umpires who are females now. But this was a rough business. So really, you're trying to make calls on this vast field just based on your own eyesight with no help from any other umpires. And things got ugly. I found in my research that this perception that early baseball was gentlemanly and polite is absolutely not true. These were laboring men, and if they had a bad season, they were back in their hometowns working in a mine or a factory or these real laboring jobs. So there were fights between teams, players on umpires, fans chasing umpires out of stadiums. There was a game at the San Francisco in the early 1900s where they were so upset with this umpire that they found his streetcar that was taking him back to his hotel and they began shaking it back and forth and shook it off the rack. So umpiring was a very hazardous job back then.
The game, again, especially early on, but not entirely, is also full of all kinds of tricks, and we'll get into some of those a little bit later, but also mistakes like just again defining the field, the playing area was in a Tacoma instance, it was subject to a surveyor's error.
That's right. Tacoma was accidentally laid out incorrectly for 30 years. Their ballpark was accidentally drawn at an 84 and a half degree angle instead of 90 degrees. So for more than 30 seasons, the field was too narrow. And a lot of balls that landed foul should have been called fair. So it was actually beneficial to pitchers. It gave them a smaller field for hits to potentially land in. And it's just amazing to think of that the mistake went unnoticed for all that time.
Well, at least I guess it was equal for the two teams playing.
That's true.
That would help. But there are also some instances of skullduggery, too. For example, a case where a player, with the help, I think, of a groundskeeper, skulked into the field by night and moved home plate.
Yes, this was a pitcher, Johnny Vandermeer, who is the answer to a trivia question. He's the only major league pitcher ever to throw back-to-back no-hitters. In 1936, he was playing for the Durham Bulls, a Class B team in North Carolina. long before the famous movie Bull Durham about the Durham Bulls. This is decades before that. But Vandermeer was having a tough time throwing strikes over the outside corner. So he broke into the ballpark at midnight. Nobody was around except the groundskeeper who helped him with this. And they dug up home plate, moved it 3 inches toward first base. Nobody noticed. And Vandermeer, in his upcoming starts, got more called strikes over that outside corner.
So in that case, it was not equal treatment for the two teams.
That's right. That was straight up cheating, moving one of the bases.
Now, there was a case early on where the ball was actually knocked in two. How did that play out?
Yes, this was a very interesting note to come across. This was in one of the old baseball guides, and I later, I guess, got it confirmed. Is confirmed the right way to say this? It's such an unusual story, but various newspaper articles mentioned it as well. It was a Pennsylvania State League game, and it was decided by half of a run. And your listeners are thinking, well, how do you score half of a run? Allentown, Pennsylvania's Mike Kilroy broke his bat in the 11th inning in a home game against Pottsville. And that was the last available bat that his team had. And reportedly, he walked to a nearby woodpile, grabbed an axe, because of course a baseball dugout is just going to have an axe in it.
Sure.
He brought it to the batter's box, reportedly swung at the next pitch, connected, and the ball split in half. One part of the ball was caught by the first baseman. The other half went flying over the fence. And the umpire said, half of a ball over the fence, that's half of a run.
They literally calculated it that way. He gets half a run.
That's what the article said. And in the book, there's only four or five stories that I feared were apocryphal. But what I did there was I wrote reportedly, because I love this story. It's funny. I love the half a run part. I wasn't there to witness this one. It happened in 1894, so I wasn't able to interview anyone who was. So I put reportedly. I felt like that cleared me if this particular story sounds maybe hard to confirm.
More recently, though, there was a case in Texas of people shooting a fly ball.
There was this colorful umpire, Steamboat Johnson. Johnson umpired more minor league games than anybody in history. He went from the early 1900s to the late 1930s. And he was a real character. People actually would buy tickets to go watch the umpire. He'd bellow out the starting lineups in a very flamboyant, dramatic way. He would run next to base runners and slide next to them to get a closer view. This is the type of thing this guy would do. And he also is one of the first baseball umpires to write an autobiography. And this has been reprinted, and I just devoured it. I was able to confirm some of the stories via newspaper archives. One of the stories that Steamboat Johnson tells is that he's umpiring a game, and there were some cowboys that had bet money on the game. And in the ninth inning, with the bases loaded, this deep fly ball appears ready to soar over the fence. And this, if it goes over the fence for a home run, is about to cost these cowboys some money. So reportedly, one of them pulls out his pistol and shoots the ball. And a steamboat said, blew it to smithereens. Talk about the accurate aim of this shooter. Shot a moving ball and blew it up. Well, then an umpire has a decision to make. What is the rule when the baseball explodes?
Not to mention the police.
Exactly. He said because the ball disappeared from his view, he decided to call it a grand slam.
Well, I guess there were some instances that you mentioned of balls that just disappear in fog and they have to call it as best they can.
Yes. In fact, one of my favorite stories that I researched in this book involves a ball disappearing. And there are some big baseball names in this story. It was 1978. It's at Jersey City, New Jersey. And Ricky Henderson, the all-time stolen base king, was playing in a double-A game for Jersey City. The visiting team is Bristol, Connecticut, and they have Wade Boggs, also a Hall of Famer. And in this one, I was able to speak with players on the field and communicate with a fan who was in the stands and employees at the park, and they all verified it. A fly ball was hit to right field, and the ball vanished. It was a clear night, but nobody saw it go over the fence, land on the field, or land in the stands. Okay. Players are just looking at each other and wondering what happened. And in this case, the umpire decided to give the batter a double. And the reason why I do believe that this ball truly did vanish and that nobody knows what happened is that the umpires had to decide what the rule was. If you knew where the ball was, there's already a rule in place. But they had to decide, what are we going to do here? But that was a really fun one because as I was tracking down people for that story, that was back in 2017, and the game took place in 1978. And 40 years later, everybody in different parts of the country that I spoke to described it the exact same way. So to me, that was really exciting to get that one in the book.
They never found the ball?
No, that was my follow-up question. What happened to this ball? There was a kid behind the outfield wall who was holding a baseball, and he was sort of a suspect for a while in this mystery. But it turns out that was not the game ball. That was one that he brought maybe to get autographed or something like that. They truly did not know what happened to this ball. I recently got an email from somebody who read the book, and they said that David Copperfield, the magician, is apparently from New Jersey, near there. So they wonder, did the magician somehow make it disappear in flight?
Yeah, well, you do have a couple of stories about UFOs and ball fields, so.
Yeah, that's another one I love. People in the UFO world talk about the Mariana incident. In 1950, the general manager of the Great Falls team in Montana went outside his ballpark because he saw some flying saucers. And with a very primitive video recorder, 16 millimeter film, I think, he took video of this. And it is now known as the Mariana UFO incident. It's known as one of our country's first unexplained UFO videos. There were newspaper archives that show that after that, he was contacted by the United States Air Force. They asked to see the film. This was a really big deal. So now there's a team, as we speak to you right now, in Great Falls, Montana, and their name is the Great Falls Voyagers, and their logo is a spaceship. So I love this. They've taken this part of baseball history and Great Falls history, and they've made it part of their new team name.
There is a closer to Earth team, or has been a team in Beloit, Wisconsin, where the balls occasionally end up in another state.
Yes, this is their new stadium in Beloit, which I've heard is beautiful. And as your listeners there know, they are right on the Illinois line. ABC Supply Stadium, home of the Beloit Sky Carp. The field is in Wisconsin, but foul balls hit over the first base side stands, sometimes land on Sherland Avenue. And if you bounce over that street, they can go into Illinois.
So a little jurisdictional issue there, I guess.
That's right. Who owns this foul ball?
You have one story about actually the press box, which of course would be a near and dear subject to you, but a press box that was rebuilt and with an incredible mistake.
That's right. In the 1940s, the Newport News Dodgers press box was knocked down in a hurricane. Newport News is right on the coast in Virginia. So the construction crew rebuilt it, and they felt pretty good about the job they did. Well, then the media showed up, and they found out that the press box had its windows facing the wrong direction. So you open up the windows, and you can see the parking lot, but then this thick wall behind you prevents you from seeing the field, which is the whole point of a press box, to be able to cover a game and see what's happening. And the book's illustrator did a great job with a funny illustration of this one, where you see the media members with question marks above their heads looking at some cars.
We're going to look further at this wacky world of minor league baseball, including some pranks and penalties, when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air, and we're looking at some Tales from the Dugout. This is the name of a new book by Tim Haggerty, and it's been published in 2023 with the subtitle 1001 Humorous, Inspirational, and Wild Anecdotes from Minor League Baseball. And it turns out they are legion. And we've been talking about occasional mistakes here, certainly notoriously rebuilding the press box pointing the wrong direction, but also we've already touched on some of the pranks in minor league baseball, which are also legion. And at the beginning of this hour, I mentioned this potato trick. It's kind of hard to believe, but that really happened.
Yes, this was in a double-A game in Williamsport, Pennsylvania in 1987. It's known in baseball circles as the Great Potato Caper. The catcher, Dave Bresnahan, actually threw a potato down the left field line in 1987. So the Reading Phillies opposing runner is at third. Bresnahan asked for time, jogged back to the dugout, grabbed a new glove with a peeled potato hidden in it. The next pitch comes in. He catches the actual ball, transfers the potato to his throwing hand, and whipped the potato past the third baseman on purpose into left field. Redding's runner thought this was the baseball. He runs home to try and score and is completely confused when Bresnahan is holding the baseball and tags him out. Well, the fans loved it. They thought it was hysterical. The problem is Cleveland, the major league team that ran Williamsport, they were not laughing about this. They looked at this as a mockery to the game. They thought it was an embarrassment to their organization. And Bresnahan was released the next day.
What was he thinking?
My guess is ballplayers being ballplayers, they joked about this in a hypothetical way. And one day he just thought, I'm going to do it. And it cost him his job.
A little too much sunshine out there, maybe.
Right.
I guess there is a minor trend of hidden balls, too, in baseball, minor league baseball.
Yes, I know, for example, the team in Asheville, North Carolina, used to purposefully hide baseballs in the shrubs out near the outfield fence. And that way, when an actual batted ball was hit out there, if they were a little bit too far away from it, they'd grab one of the balls they had stashed for quicker access and throw it in. And everybody thought it was the game ball. Well, one day they got caught when two baseballs came flying in, one per outfielder out in left center field at the same time, which of course would never happen. There's only one ball at a time. And they got busted.
What was the result?
The result was one of the players was ejected, and the runner who was tagged out by one of the baseballs, the umpire said, no, you're safe. That was in the 1950s in the Tri-State League in Asheville, North Carolina.
I also mentioned this situation at the beginning of the hour about this base runner and the base coach. Tell us about the role of base coaches and the extent to which base runners are supposed to obey them and what happens when they don't.
That's right. This story is from Jack McKeon, longtime baseball man, was a general manager, was a major league manager, really into his 80s, continued having a major role in Major League Baseball. Well, Jack McKeon one day was coaching third base, and he had this base runner, Juan Vistor, who kept ignoring his stop signs. McKeon's job as the third base coach, when there's a ball in play, is to tell that runner coming from second either to hold at third base or to keep on running and try to score, because the third base coach has a better angle of the outfield compared to a base runner who has his back to the outfield on that play. Well, this guy just kept on running through McKeon's suggested stop signs. He just kept trying to score, even though his coach told him not to. One day, McKeon bought a starter pistol, loaded it with blanks, brought it to the third base coach's box in Greensboro, North Carolina, and the next time that player ran past a stop sign, McKeon fired a few loud but fake shots. Vistor was convinced that gunshots were real. He fell to the ground. He thought somebody was targeting him, and then he retreated to third base. So this was in 1960. And it's safe to say, Norman, that this would not happen in 2023.
No. Is this a case where the third base coach maybe got penalized in some form?
That's a good question. McKeon tells this story and has done interviews about it and did not mention that. I wonder if in 1960... the attitude was, well, that's Jack being Jack, and that'll teach the runner to stop ignoring his third base coach.
And it was probably a one-off. And
that's right.
Behind them. There's also an incident you mentioned where the manager disguises himself as the mascot?
Yes, this was in Boise, Idaho. His name was Tom Kochman. Kochman was another real character, and it was during the late 1980s. He gets thrown out of the game, and when a manager gets ejected, they must retreat to the clubhouse where they have no view of the field at all. They cannot make any decisions for the rest of that game. And that really frustrates a manager. That's their job, is to decide what new pitcher's coming in, what play to put on, when do I send a base runner.
And they don't have
really feel
they don't have a backup for that?
They do. A member of the coaching staff becomes the manager.
But that's not good enough.
Exactly. When you're the manager, you want to be the one calling the shots. So Kochman gets ejected, goes into Boise's clubhouse, and it just so happens that the mascot, Humphrey the Hawk for the Boise Hawks, is in there to get some air conditioning. He has his head off of the mascot suit. He's just in there trying to cool off. Kochman says, "Hey, can I borrow that suit?" The manager gets into the mascot suit, goes back into the dugout, and starts managing the game from the mascot suit because the umpires, of course, don't know that he's in there.
And that's not cracking up the players. They managed to keep a straight face through this.
They were, somehow. What finally got Kochman caught was the league president happened to be there evaluating that game. And he said, "Why does the mascot have cleats on? That wouldn't normally happen." So he did a little digging, found out, and Kochman got suspended.
With
a smile, I should add, Norman, the league president who told me that story is this man, Jack Kane. And Kane, even though he had to suspend Kochman, he did it with a smile. He's basically saying, "Okay, you can't do this, but I appreciate your effort."
Who won the game?
You know, that's a great question. I had a chance to interview both of those participants, but I don't recall if that led to a win or not.
Let's get into the wonderful world of umpires. That's got to be one of the most thankless jobs in all of baseball.
Absolutely. I found a story from the early 1900s. There was this umpire, Tiny Parker, and he was working a game in Daytona Beach, Florida, and the fans believe that he blew a call, and there was this bridge that wasn't too far above the river outside the stadium, but a group of fans got so upset with him that they actually pushed him over this bridge into the water. And this poor guy had his briefcase. He's got his umpiring equipment. The next day, Tiny Parker shows up to work the next day's game. And the fans felt so badly that they took up a collection to buy him some new umpiring equipment and a new briefcase. So, Norman, I feel it's the least you can do if you're going to throw an umpire into a river is to buy him some new gear.
Yes, let's hope that it's never necessary to actually write that into the rule book, but it was a wonderful
That's right.
time. You mentioned an umpire who wrote an autobiography. And you also have a story about an umpire who got, if not beaned, at least, let's say, attacked with books.
Yes, that was Steamboat Johnson, the same umpire that we spoke about earlier in the show about the Cowboys who shot the live ball. It was just flying in the air. Steamboat Johnson wrote an autobiography while he was an umpire, and he would travel city to city prior to the games. In the mornings, they were all day games in his era. In the mornings, he would sell the books at the stadium, and then he'd go and he'd work the game. Well, one day in Mobile, Alabama, he made a bad call, and the dozens of fans who had bought his book got so mad at him that they threw the books back on the field. So he's trying to dodge his own books being thrown at him. And Steamboat punctuates the story by saying, "I just picked up the books and sold them the next day in Memphis."
That's very resourceful, and many an author could learn that kind of thing about recycled books. There was a sinister plot hatched in Milwaukee one time having to do with an umpire.
Yeah, this was in 1905. Two Milwaukee players brewed a plan to hurt an umpire. Pitcher's name was Jack Hickey, and he got together with his catcher, Ronald Wolf, and they had Wolf intentionally miss a high fastball so it would hit the umpire in the head. The umpire was so upset that he gave Indianapolis a forfeit win when he found out they did it on purpose. And that was an interesting thing, speaking of Wisconsin, in the research of this book. I found just what a deep baseball history Wisconsin has long before the Brewers. I mean, stories like this in 1905 of professional baseball in Milwaukee.
For sure, and again, a lot of color there too, and we'll get into some Milwaukee stories a little bit later. What is the penalty? I hesitate to ask this, but what is the penalty for spitting on an umpire?
Well, there have been a couple of incidents, and they made their way into my book. I think it would vary per league. For example, I know a player named Frederick Shoemaker spit on a sports writer in 1941. He got released. The sports writer called Shoemaker a crybaby in the newspaper the previous day. And Shoemaker saw the article, raged up to the press box, spit tobacco juice in the sports writer's face, and was later suspended for a year. At the time, Shoemaker was only 21, And as far as I could find, he never played professional baseball again. So even back then, in sort of a wild time, that could have cost him his career.
Yeah, so there are penalties that are implicit and penalties in addition that are, of course, explicit in those cases. Yeah. You had another case where a player was accused of spitting on an umpire. Actually, a manager was accused of spitting on an umpire, and he beat the rap in a very unusual way.
Yes, they used a lie detector test. The International League used polygraph evidence to overturn a suspension in 1953. The league had initially disciplined Buffalo's manager, Jack Tighe, for spitting on an umpire. Tighe insisted that the spitting was unintentional. He was just speaking passionately, trying to argue a call. He even offered to take a polygraph test. Well, the International League said, okay, if you're offering that, let's do it. They went to the Buffalo Police Department, asked to use the equipment, and Tighe passed the test, and the league ended his suspension.
How long can a baseball game go? I'm sure that there are some non-fans who would say forever, or maybe even some fans, but what kind of records do we see in minor league baseball?
Well, when you think about North Dakota, you might not think about baseball history, but that's where the longest scoreless game ever was. July 18th, 1891, Fargo and Grand Forks played 25 scoreless innings.
That must have been exciting.
And that's right, 0 runs scored. The umpire ended the game after 25 innings, not because of darkness, which was sometimes an issue prior to night games, but the reason he ended the game is that both teams had to catch a train. They were traveling city to city by train back then, and the train's not going to wait for you. So it's not like these days where a team might take a bus like the Wisconsin Timber Rattlers do, going from one city to another, and then the bus leaves when you're ready. It wasn't like that. The train was ready to go, so they ended the game 0-0 after 25 innings.
Well, speaking of the Timber Rattlers, I can't help mentioning that I saw a performance there one time, not of a baseball game, but of the Royal Fireworks music of Handel, and there was a bit of a mishap, which didn't hurt anybody, but it made things unexpectedly exciting. And the other thing I noticed, I hope I don't get in trouble for saying this, is I thought it was charming, but after the game, here's a certain figure walking up and down the seats, cleaning things out, and it was a skunk.
Oh.
That was a very charming evening in some unexpected ways at Timber Rattler Stadium.
Well, of course, Appleton is known for its paper production, and they tied that into a unique promotion in 2012. They had Salute to Toilet Paper Night, and that became a fun story that was picked up in newspapers around the country.
Should I even ask how they celebrated that?
Luckily, they kept things clean. It wasn't really bathroom humor, but they had toilet paper streaming down from the rafters, and they built this massive toilet paper roll pyramid. And instead of throwing out a ceremonial first pitch, they had Ben Hill, a national sports writer who happened to be in town, throw out a ceremonial roll of toilet paper to the catcher.
How short can a game be, though? I can imagine as a broadcaster that could be a little awkward if the game suddenly is over.
Yes, these days, with pace of play rules that have been instituted over the past couple of years, games are going back to a more normal pace after baseball slowed down for a couple of years. That trend has been fixed, but not quite as fast as a 31-minute game. In 1916, Winston-Salem and Asheville in North Carolina agreed to rapid speed-up rules so they could catch an afternoon train. There's another train story. So base runners just kept on running until they were tagged out. Pitchers lobbed the ball over the plate on purpose, and sometimes fielders would be running to and from the dugout even before an inning ended. And now it's a fun story. It's great for things like my book. But at the time, the spectators were furious. These people paid full admission, and they're seeing this farce of a game, 9 innings and 31 minutes. And the team owner actually refunded all of the fans' money.
There have been some very strange trades in minor league baseball. I mentioned again at the beginning of the hour, a pitcher traded for 10 pounds of catfish.
Yes, these are two independent league teams. And as we talked about earlier, independent league teams are professional, players are paid, but they are not an affiliate of a major league organization. So sometimes they can get creative with trades. A team in California, the Pacific Suns, traded a pitcher, Ken Crahenbuhl, to Greenville in Mississippi. And not quite knowing what to ask for in return, the Greenville Bluesmen sent them 10 pounds of Mississippi catfish. This was in 1998.
I was going to say, so, see, that's the kind of story you'd expect from 1908 or 1895
exactly.
or something, but 1998.
Exactly. And my guess is that the team in California had an excess of pitchers. The team in Mississippi was needing pitchers. And it really was a new opportunity for this player, and they decided to have some fun with it. So they traded the pitcher for 10 pounds of Mississippi catfish. And the thing is, he became known for more than that because in his first game in Greenville, Mississippi, he threw a perfect game.
Wow.
Nobody reached base against him, a real baseball rarity. So it makes you wonder if the first team maybe regretted trading him for catfish.
Yeah, he would have been worth a lot more catfish.
That's right.
There have been some other trades like that too, haven't there?
Yes, I love the story of the player who was traded for a turkey. Chattanooga had this really eccentric owner, Joe Engel, who would do anything to sell tickets or to get in the newspaper. And in 1931, he traded his shortstop to Charlotte for a turkey. And he then served this turkey at a winter banquet. And when the sports writers covering the banquet asked him why he'd traded his player for a turkey, he said because the turkey was having a better year.
Oh, ouch.
Ouch.
Generally speaking, how do players feel about being traded?
I think it varies a lot. In some cases, it's more positive than people might think because it's a new opportunity. There is a player for the team that I broadcast for. My full-time job is the voice of the Padres AAA team in El Paso, Texas. And there was this player, Tucapita Marcano. And in 2021, the San Diego Padres traded him to the Pittsburgh Pirates. And he was young, and this was such a raw, emotional thing for him that he actually was crying. He felt, my employer doesn't want me.
Right.
But the manager actually sat him down and he said, they actually are trading you because they're getting this Major League All-Star. That's how much your new team thinks of you, that they said, we want you. So what he did is he explained to the young player that this is actually a positive. Don't look at it as your employer is getting rid of you. Look at it as this new team called up and said, we want you. And now he's in the major leagues with the Pirates, and it's turned out to be a great thing in his career.
Do you suppose sometimes that's actually a motivation for a player that might be underperforming to prove his mettle?
Absolutely. There are stories throughout baseball history, especially when they then play that team that traded them, that can really provide some extra motivation. You didn't think I was good. I'm going to show you.
We'll get some Brewers stories and also look at some fan behavior and even get into some insights about some slightly unusual announcer innovations, if you want to call it that, when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Tim Haggerty, the author of Tales from the Dugout, 1001 Humorous, Inspirational, and Wild Anecdotes from Minor League Baseball, published in 2023 by Cider Mill Press. Well, we promised a couple of Brewers stories, Tim, and so we better deliver. We've already had a couple of them, but you have a couple more.
Yeah, I love the Brewers story that goes back to 1994 of the pitcher who got injured by a phone book. So in 1994, it was spring training, and spring training is typically a time to get players back into condition, but also maybe to gather and have some team-building activities. So this is when teams will invite in a motivational speaker or some sort of entertainer. And the Brewers hire this group of motivational speakers. And as part of their exciting routine, this big, strong guy, to show his enthusiasm for the day, grabbed a thick phone book and tore it apart. I mean, this is a full-size phone book. Well, you do that in front of a group of manly men like ballplayers, what are they going to want to do? They're going to want to try to see if they can do the same thing. So the next day, a Brewers pitcher, Steve Sparks, is trying to do it. And his fans, I should say his teammates, began chanting his name, encouraging him, you can do it, you can rip the phone book. And he's getting more and more strenuous trying to do this. And he actually injured himself. He dislocated his shoulder trying to pull apart a phone book.
How did the team explain that to the press?
Well, Steve Sparks at that time was right on the cusp of being either on the Major League squad or on the Triple-A team, and he actually got sent down. And Sparks, to this day, still does interviews about it and explains that the Brewers were furious at him. What were you thinking? The shoulder that he injured was his non-throwing shoulder, so it didn't affect his career. He did eventually make it to the majors. I think the Brewers were honest with the fans and with the press. The biggest anger was more the team toward the player for what they felt was an irresponsible thing to do.
But they were egging him on.
Yes, his teammates were egging him on. I should say the general manager and the manager, the players' bosses, did not like that he wouldn't think that this could be a dangerous thing to do. They were the ones who were mad.
Imagine there's a lot of strain being a coach or a manager of a group of lively, adventuresome, fairly young people who don't necessarily know how best to conduct themselves.
It can be, for sure. I think it's probably like a lot of your listeners' workplaces where a manager once told me, 80% of my problems come from 20% of my players. That for the most part, the players are hardworking, respectful, well-behaved, but there's a group on each team that maybe isn't. But again, my full-time job is the broadcaster for a Triple-A team. Those managers, though, have the rare opportunity throughout their career occasionally to tell a player that they're going to the major leagues for the first time. That's the ultimate for a minor league manager.
Sure.
And recently, the team I broadcast for, they have this player, Taylor Colway. He went to the University of Wisconsin La Crosse. There were hundreds and hundreds of players drafted before him. He's from Holman up near La Crosse. And this guy was not a prospect. This was not somebody that publications are writing about as a future major leaguer, but he kept working, kept working. He is not one of the problem childs that we're talking about. He is a respectful, soft-spoken Midwest guy who worked so hard. And recently, the manager had a chance to tell him, "You're going to the major leagues." And it was a really emotional moment, not only for the player, but also for the manager who had worked with him for years on improving his skills.
You have another Milwaukee story too, I believe.
Yes, in 2003, of course, your listeners who have been to Brewers games know about the racing sausages. That is one of the things that the Brewers are so well known for, the between innings sausage race. Well, in 2003, Pittsburgh's first baseman, Randall Simon, decided to playfully affect the race. He was in the third base dugout, and he stuck his bat out and lightly hit one of the sausage racing costumes. And the woman inside it, a 19-year-old Mandy Wagner, fell to the ground and lost the race. And this became a popular video on a lot of the highlight shows. Well, local law enforcement didn't look at it as a joke. They actually questioned Simon, and Simon was fined for disorderly conduct. Major League Baseball wasn't really impressed either. They suspended him 3 games. Now, Mandy Wagner did interviews about this and told MLB.com that, quote, she thought it was hilarious. Luckily, she was not injured. She was in a thick, padded costume, but yeah, a Pittsburgh Pirates player took out one of the sausages. How could he do that?
You got to wonder, do minor league teams like major league teams, do they have like staff psychologists to deal with various issues behind the scenes?
They do. The players and the coaches are all under the employment of the Major League organization. So for the team I broadcast for, we are a San Diego Padres affiliate, and they do. They have psychologists, they have an employee assistance program, they have people that come and talk about visualization. I remember covering a game 18 years ago now, and a San Diego Padres employee who specializes in that sort of thing told me, take a piece of paper and put a pen dot in the middle of it. That's how little we have figured out when it comes to athletes and how the mind can help them. He just felt that that was such a vast opportunity to have people perform better. And I can see that organizations have put a lot of focus on that. These days, you talk to a ball player in his early 20s, and they're saying things like staying present, one pitch at a time, not worrying about the next day's game, not worrying about the previous day's
You hear
game.
that, yeah.
Yeah, I think that today's athlete in all sports have really been trained on the mental side of the games.
It is an interesting phenomenon in general that you have not just the players who are the focus of the phenomenon, but all the spectators kind of just venting moment to moment spontaneously. And the psychology of that is mind-boggling when you think about it, and the interaction.
Absolutely. And as I talk to players, they are people just like us. I think sometimes there's a perception that they're wealthy, that they're famous, that they're high maintenance. And maybe in some cases, there's a little bit of a case like that. But these athletes have bad days too. I guess you and I can relate to it a little bit. I'm sure, well, maybe not you, Norman, but most of us broadcasters have made a mistake before.
And, no.
That it feels bad when maybe you get a message and somebody lets you know that you made that mistake. And that happens with athletes too. They are performing on a stage in front of thousands of people. And in a lot of cases, they are known for their one big mistake in their career and not necessarily all the success they had leading up to an error or a missed call by an official.
Yeah, that's it's a really tough psychology in that way in particular. Some of the fans have been known to expose their psychology too. I'm thinking, for example, of what was it, Brownie Day?
That's right. This was in New Jersey in 2001. It was Brownie's Troop Night. And the New Jersey Cardinals probably didn't think they needed extra security for Brownie Troop Night. But the mother of one of the Girl Scouts was so upset about an umpire's call that she bolted from her seat, climbed over the wall, and ran onto the field chasing the umpire. She was not only ejected from the park, but she also got arrested.
There have been some other issues having to do with fields that are a little less out of the control of the players and the managers and the owners and the spectators, having to do with wildlife.
Yes, there was a game in New Orleans in 1908, and a monkey ran on the field. New Orleans had a chimpanzee that was in this cage as a mascot of sorts. Well, somebody let it out of the cage, and it began hopping all around the field chasing players. So there's actually been a monkey delay in professional baseball history.
Some grasshoppers, too, I think, got out of hand, to say the least.
Yes, this is a wild story. In Midland, Texas, in the 1970s, there was a doubleheader one night, and thousands of grasshoppers had gathered behind the outfield wall. And something about when they turned on the stadium lights, all these grasshoppers flocked everywhere. And the cloud of grasshoppers was so thick around the field that players told me they couldn't see their teammates on the field because of all these grasshoppers in their vision.
The footing must have been pretty bad, too.
Exactly. It was thousands of them everywhere. There's descriptions about fans dancing in the stands because these grasshoppers are fluttering into their clothes. So the game was postponed, and the city of Midland actually had to fumigate the whole city to take care of these grasshoppers that were everywhere.
Is that better or worse than tarantulas?
Ooh. Well, it's funny you mentioned that, because that also was in Midland, Texas. It made me think during my research, what is going on in Midland at this ballpark that they have grasshoppers and tarantulas? I heard this story from Lee Smith, the Hall of Fame pitcher. He was one of the pitchers involved in this. And on this case, it had to do with the grounds crew chemicals, where something about the chemical made hundreds of tarantulas crawl all over the field. And they actually had to halt the game because of these thick spiders everywhere.
Well, speaking of games in Texas, there was also a glitch having to do with, was that passports of one of the teams or members of the team?
Yes. It was actually the Reno team. And at this time, this league that was based in California, but also Reno, Nevada, they actually had teams in Mexico. This was the Sunset League. And in 1948, Reno was trying to get to Mexicali, and it was postponed because Reno's bus encountered immigration issues when trying to get into Mexico. And the paperwork process dragged on and on. And this really hurt Mexicali's organization because they had thousands of fans there for a Saturday night game with beautiful weather. And you can imagine how they reacted after waiting and then being told on this beautiful night there's not going to be a game because our opposing team is stuck at the border.
Regarding announcers, your line of work, there's a famous story about Ronald Reagan, when he was an announcer, in effect fabricating a horse race because he did not get the information in time. I gather you've never had to do that in this age of more modern technology, but not so, so long ago, there were carrier pigeons involved in play-by-play.
That's right. Decades ago, the play-by-play announcer did not always travel to the road games. They would go to the radio station and would receive telegraph updates on the play-by-play. So let's say that Fond du Lac is broadcasting a game that's actually taking place in Wausau. The announcer would stay in Fond du Lac and receive the Western Union telegraph updates, and it would say something like ground ball to shortstop, and the imaginative announcer would describe the play as he or she imagined it, and the radio listening audience might think he's actually at the game. Well, the announcer in 1952 in Ventura, California, was in a tough position because there was a Western Union telegraph operator strike. So there's no telegraph, but they somehow trained a carrier pigeon to fly from the stadium with a piece of paper directly to the radio station. And then the announcer would receive this piece of paper, and it would be a list of plays. And he would then deliver the play-by-play based on this paper that was delivered by a carrier pigeon. And to me, Norman, I at first loved this story, went through newspaper archives to find the exact date back in 1952, that type of thing. But it also sent me down a research rabbit hole when it came to carrier pigeons. I mean, even aside from baseball, they were amazing.
Well, yes, they'd have to be fast. They'd have to have good stamina. And of course, they'd have to have a very good idea of where they were supposed to go. Well, we could have a good time sitting in the bleachers and hearing stories from Tim Haggerty. There are at least 1,001 of them in his book, Tales from the Dugout, and we've gotten a good sample from a very articulate and an announcer with a very good memory, too. And it's been a real treat, Tim Haggerty, hearing some of your many tales from the dugout.
Well, thank you. It's so great to talk to you today, Norman. I love Wisconsin. I've been to ball games there, and it's really exciting to be on the radio in Wisconsin.
Well, pleasure having you. I'm Norman Gilliland. I hope you can join me next time around for University of the Air.